I'll try again. There it goes. It is working now. Okay. So every area of life which is used as a service in the temple, that's going to bring blessing to the area of life. So just like the bread brings blessing to the bread that we have in our everyday homes, and you know, the bread that a person would eat for breakfast, lunch, or dinner will be blessed to the bread in the temple, so too when it comes to areas of the area of fire, we'll discuss that in a minute, this should bring blessing to fire. So I'll discuss what it means, blessing, why you need blessing on your fire. We'll get to that in 1 second. But the Gemara just tells us a fascinating point in general, which is that anywhere we put efforts for the sake of God in life, so we should be blessed in the area of life. So somebody who's involved in, let's say, cooking for those who are sick, so then you should find blessing in the world of cooking. You know, somebody who's involved in, you know, driving somebody who needs help, so you should find blessing, let's say, in your car, if you have car problems. I mean, any area which you're putting efforts in to serve God, you should actually find blessings in those areas. That's what the Talmud tells us. So, good question.
Sorry, Rabbi, I'm confused. The fifth of the items, the constant miracles, was produced no smoke.
Yes.
Then we talked about the smoke going straight up.
So we said it depends on which kind of, there's two fires on the altar. There was the human-made fire and the miraculous heavenly-made fire. Okay. So the heavenly-made fire did not produce smoke. The human-made fire produced smoke.
Thank you.
In straight column, no problem. So the Gemara tells a story of a man named Nechunya Chofer Shichin. His nickname was Nechunya, the one who digs wells. And he got that nickname because he took it upon himself. The Jews used to have to go make a pilgrimage to the temple on the three regalim, on Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot. And, you know, they were in the hot Middle East. You know, there wasn't running water in those days. There wasn't convenience stores along the way to buy a drink, and people were thirsty. So he took it upon himself to dig wells on the roads so that people had water to drink as they made their pilgrimage to the temple. And it was a very big mitzvah, a very special mitzvah. It happened one time that his daughter had fallen into a well, and she was drowning. She couldn't get out of the well. His name was Nechunya Chofer Shichin, was his name. Somebody in the Talmud. So Nechunya's daughter fell into a well. And he was very nervous, obviously. She couldn't get out. She was stuck. She may drown in the well. And he went to a certain rabbi. I forgot who it was. And this rabbi said, don't worry. That can be a problem. He said, you know, by now she's already out. He wasn't even there. He was somewhere else. He said, don't worry. She'll be out of the well by now. And it turned out that that moment he said she'd be out of the well, she got out of the well miraculously. And she said, it was a miracle. You know, this man came and he came and he pulled me out. It was a miraculous salvation. So they said to this rabbi, how did you know that was going to happen? I mean, you weren't even there. You weren't watching. He said, because it couldn't be that somebody who has given of himself for the community by digging wells is going to be damaged and have a child killed in a well. It can't be, because God's going to bring blessing in wells to a person who's dug wells for the community. That's what the rabbi told them. So the concept is where we put forth efforts to serve God, we should find blessing in those areas in some way.
Is there any mitzvah, like the mitzvah you described were mitzvah of chesed?
Right.
If somebody puts a lot of mitzvah into venturing, you know, taking hold of an esrog.
Yeah. So you have to find where it would extend to. But the Gemara says, for instance, somebody who's very careful with tzitzis will merit having beautiful clothing. That's what the Gemara says. If you're careful with tzitzis, you'll merit beautiful clothing.
Beautiful clothing.
Yeah. Somebody who's careful with, I can't remember the other, there's a few examples the Gemara gives along those terms, along those lines. If you're careful with mezuzah, you should merit having a beautiful house. You know, somebody puts forth these efforts to really be careful in certain areas of mitzvot, so they'll merit to be blessed in those areas. And you find examples like that throughout the Gemara. So in the temple, they had put forth effort to do this mitzvah and provide a fire. So through the service of God in the world of fire, we're going to be blessed in the world of fire. So Sefer Chinuch writes, so what does it mean we're blessed through fire? I mean, no one has an issue with making a fire. That's not usually our problem. Maybe you need to get some wood for the fire. Maybe you need to pay your gas bill. I mean, those are areas which it could be we need to have help in the realm of fire. But Sefer Chinuch writes that the term fire, in a bigger sense, a more metaphoric sense, refers to the energy within a person. And the energy in a person needs to be in a proper balance. You know, the natural, what we call it, you know, the heat that we have, the energy we have. So that's being the right balance. So some people, if you don't have, you know, people get depressed, people get sluggish, they don't act, they don't do, and that's a very terrible thing. some people have so much energy that they overdo themselves, that either they get on people's nerves, they destroy projects, and even if somebody has too much energy, it's just overwhelming. So it's important to have that proper balance. The children of Aaron, Aaron HaKohen, Nadav and Avihu. So what happened? They went overboard with fire. They were so excited to serve God with fire, they went into the Holy of Holies, and they were consumed by fire. So that's an example, he says, of somebody whose energy, and they both literally in the fire itself, they overdid fire, and the fire consumed them. And it burnt up their insides, the Torah says, because it was the internal push which was inappropriate. Sometimes to push too hard is inappropriate as well. So that was the area of fire, which we would call it our own energy, our own ambition, which wasn't in proper balance, and therefore they were burnt because of it. So therefore, the service in the temple with fire, the Sefer Chinuch writes, is supposed to help us be blessed in the realm of our own personal inner energy, inner fire. And we make sure that we reach a proper balance. It also means, he also implies, it means medically as well. We maintain a body temperature, you know, we're warm-blooded. And you know, if your temperature goes up or down, that's dangerous. So to maintain that proper balance physically as well, that's the blessing of fire, the person says. That's the person's natural body heat. So you have this concept of fire, whether it be body heat, energy, or ambition, but you have to keep that in proper balance, or else it'll be negative one way or the other. Either you won't accomplish and you'll be depressed, or you'll go overboard and do things which are not appropriate as well because you have too much pushing. So those are some basic ideas of the mitzvah of maintaining the fire. Now, Sefer HaChinuch brings up a different discussion, which is related, which is actually a fundamental idea of Judaism in general. He says, if you look at the mitzvah of providing fire upon the altar, you have this interesting balance. On the one hand, God provides the miraculous fire. On the other hand, he tells the human being, you have to bring fire yourself. So we had a mitzvah to add wood and to maintain a fire physically, a human fire, but also God provided heavenly fire. So why do you need both? So he says that when God does miracles, and you can see this throughout the entire Torah, when God does a miracle, God always does a miracle in a very subtle way. God tries to fit it to nature. Meaning that, for instance, he brings an example, if you look at the splitting of the sea. So the Torah described this, the winds were blowing very hard, there was an eastern wind that was blowing very hard all day and all night, and then the sea split and dried out. So one could watch and say, wow, it was the Jews' lucky day. They had a tremendous, we'll call it a freak of nature, but the wind blew so hard that day, it was able to split the sea and dry out the land in an instant. And there are, I believe, some historians and scientists which actually worked out ways how could be a sea could split naturally, which I think is ridiculous overall, because even if it worked in a natural manner, it happened to be the exact right moment when the Egyptians, I mean, they're taking for granted, there were Egyptians and there were Jews, and they're at the Red Sea, and the sea did split, but we're going to show how it wasn't God, it was a natural event. So who made the natural event happen? I mean, to me the whole thing's kind of silly to even... But God, when he does a miracle, he does it in a way which is going to fit the rules of nature and try to fit it within our world. He says also miracles should be hidden within natural events. So it's also, Ramban, Nachmanides points this out as well. You find it in Parshas Noah, when Noah builds the ark. So the Ramban says, well, even if you do the math, I mean, the ark is pretty big. It was 300 amos, so we'll call it about 600 feet long. It was a pretty big ship. On the other hand, if you're fitting every animal in the world in that ship, and Noah and his family, and you had all the food for the animals, and all the waste of the animals for the entire time in the ark, you're not going to fit everyone in there. So why did God make him build an ark at all? I mean, if either way, there has to be a miracle, and the ark's going to end up fitting more than it really can physically. So just save Noah in a different way. Like, what's the point of building the ark? So Ramban says, Nachmanides points out, that God always tries to minimize miracles. So, yes, there's a miracle that we could fit every single animal in the world inside that ark, every species of animal in that ark. On the other hand, he wasn't just going to, you know, pluck Noah up and let him float above the water for. He wanted to make it some sort of natural means of how to save Noah, because God tries to minimize miracles. It's a very interesting thing. So God whenever God performs a miracle, usually there is some way to minimize the miracle. Some way it can be explained naturally, happens to be the right place in the right time, but there's some natural explanation. But you know that's a concept that you see in this mitzvah. God says, I'm going to provide heavenly fire. But I don't want it to be so open, so obvious. There's a miraculous fire here. So I'm going to let you add fire yourself. And then not everybody who walks by is going to notice the miracle per se. Because the miracle is going to be kind of hidden beneath the natural human-made fire. So yes, we said, you know, it could be it appeared different. The fire looked a little different. It appeared like a lion. It had a different color to it. Either way, the miracle wasn't quite as public, quite as surprising, because people can see, oh look, you know, the human being made the fire and God shaped it. Or the human being made the fire and God made it and have special properties. But to say a fire just shot down from heaven, that's something that God kind of hid in this mitzvah. So that's what Sefer HaChinuch describes. Now we have to understand why God does that. See, we don't know why God does anything. That's the truth. But we have to at least give some sort of understanding as why is it that God likes to minimize or hide miracles rather than display miracles publicly. And I believe that even if you looked at, you know, the 10 plagues, splitting the sea, that probably each one could be explained based on some natural phenomenon, I assume.
And it has been,
yeah, right. Which again, if you're trying to use that to disprove God, it's silly, because why did it happen that moment? I mean, somebody even happened that moment. But God does it that way. God makes it that everything in the world could have a natural explanation. Something's going to happen which we can't explain somehow through the laws of science and nature. Something could have happened. Even when it comes to the revelation of Mount Sinai, so people discuss, you know, there's a thunderstorm and people can be hearing things. And I mean, there's some crazy theories out there that maybe the people were on some sort of drug and they hallucinated. I mean, people have some wild, wild theories. But and all these things are, you know, I believe, like I said before, it's ridiculous to even start. Once you're taking for granted it happened, then why would you deny God at that point? You know, if you want to say it did happen, that's one thing. When you say it did happen, when you're explaining it naturally, I think it's a very funny thing. Yeah. So I didn't get to that yet. I'm about to get to that. Why? I didn't get to the why yet.
Okay.
Yeah, this is all the what. But we have to get to the why. So the question is the why. So there are different approaches to this question. I'm going to share an approach with you from the book called Sichos Musar. It's based on the lectures of Rabbi Chaim Shmulevitz, who was one of the Rosh Hashivas and the Mir Yeshiva. Really in the 1960s and 70s, I think, was his heyday over there. But there's a book, they actually have it in English as well now. It's called, I think, Rabbi Chaim's Shmuzin, I think they call it in English, or Chaim Shmuzin. It's an art scroll. I think it's an art scroll Feldheim book at this point as well. But it was written originally in Hebrew, called Sichos Musar. And Rav Chaim Shmulevitz explains that why does God want to minimize a miracle? So he says that all clarity in life has to come through human efforts. God set up the world in a way where God hid himself. I mean, really, one of the fundamental ideas of Judaism overall about God is that God created a world. The word in the Hebrew for world is olam, which is the same root as helam, which means hidden. The world hides God. Why does God create a world that he's hidden within? Because he wants us to be able to have free choice, and based on our free choice, search and find God. So therefore, the world's created in a way which God is hidden. We have to reveal God through our daily lives, through our service of God, through our minds. A question?
I was just wondering what the difference, or is there a subtle difference between hidden, that you had said,
Hesper?
Helam.
And Nistar. There probably is. I don't know the difference, but usually there is. So I don't answer that. Because the other word used for hidden in Hebrew usually is Nistar, or Lahastir, is to hide. God's Hester Panim.
Helam is the word that's used by Shogeg.
Yes, right.
So, I'm going beyond my actual knowledge, but I think helam is more hidden from your awareness.
Rather than physically hidden.
Rather than physically covered up.
That could be. That's possible. That's possible. It's a good thought. So the word for world, olam, is the same root word as the word hidden. Because the world is created to hide God. The job of the human being is to seek God within this world where God is hidden and find the truth based on our own personal searching, our own personal service of God. That's our role, that's our job. We're supposed to recognize the truth based on our own human minds, based on what we've been taught from the Torah, based on our service of God in daily life. That's our goal. So he points out that we have this famous concept the rabbis teach us, that a baby inside the mother's womb is taught the entire Torah. The rabbis tell us, well, while the baby is inside the womb, he's taught the whole Torah, the angel is there as the teacher, and once the baby is born, he gets smacked, and he forgets all the Torah he learned, and he comes out as an ignorant baby. That's what the rabbis tell us. So then you say, what was the point? Why is it the baby is smacked and forgets everything? I mean, he was taught Torah, then he comes in the world and he forgets it all. So the idea is that everything is there beneath the surface in the person as well. Beneath the surface, we all were privy to the entire Torah when we were inside our mother's womb. all of us. But then God says, okay, now you have to go and find it yourself. You have it there, it's within, it's latent in the person. You have the ability, because you already know it all. But now you're being put into the world where it's all hidden from you, now you have to go out and find it. Because based on your own human efforts, you have to go now and search and discover and reveal the Torah, which was already there beneath the surface. Because just like the Torah is beneath the surface in a person, because we were taught it all as babies, as fetuses, so too the Torah is with God, is within the world, beneath the surface. It has to be found through personal efforts. There's stories about great people who had angels come to them in dreams and say, I'd like to teach you the Torah. And they refuse and say, no, because I have to do it with my own effort. There's a famous story, the one I think most famous is the Vilna Gaon. The great Vilna Gaon, he was somebody who he himself achieved probably knowledge of the entire Torah. Plus, he was the genius of the past 500 years. But he records. I don't know if he wrote it or his students wrote it, but it's a known story that he was visited by an angel in a dream, and he was offered, I'm going to teach you Torah. I'm going to study Torah with you. And he said, I'm not interested, because my job in this world is to put forth my own personal human effort to discover God and to understand God's Torah through my own personal efforts. I don't want to be spoon-fed it. I don't want it to be. If we all think, I wish I could have a computer chip implanted in my head, which would have all the knowledge I need to know for life. But the bad part about that is you didn't do it yourself. It would just be implanted within there, but if you didn't put forth your efforts, you haven't really accomplished anything. So we're not interested in that. When it comes to Torah study, when it comes to revealing God, we don't want to just have the knowledge fed into our brains. We want to be able to use our brains, put forth our own personal efforts, and understand God, reveal God, understand God's Torah. That's our job. So nothing ever comes to us on a silver platter. And it shouldn't. We don't want it to come to us. And it's for a good reason, because that gives us free choice, that gives us a challenge in life, that gives us the ability to accomplish based on our own efforts. That's why God wanted human beings to have free choice, bechira. We're supposed to have free choice. And if God just fed us everything, everything was obvious, we're born and we see God everywhere, then we have nothing to do. That's it. We have no job as human beings. So when it comes to miracles as well, so sometimes miracles have to happen. There's times where God performs miracles, and those times, we don't see them too often, but there's certain times in history that were more concentrated than others, such as the time of the Exodus, time of Matan Torah, when God gave the Torah, we saw miracles. And there have been miracles throughout history, different times, different generations, different locations. Even when a miracle occurs, even the miracle is not a silver platter either. Even when the miracle comes, there has to be some room for doubt in some way. There has to be some room where you can say, well, there's something going on here, but it's not clear to me. It has to be God. Now you see a sea split. And the Egyptians, Nachmanides points out, why did Pharaoh go in? I'm saying, they had 10 plagues, he now comes to the sea, and now the sea splits in front of them. Obviously, God is there helping out the Jews. I mean, was he crazy? Maybe he was crazy. But why did the Egyptians enter into the sea? So Nachmanides says it's because God left room for doubt, and therefore Pharaoh, with his stubborn heart, decided, I'm going to still pursue the Jews. Because there was some room for doubt. He said, yeah, even though it's pretty amazing, the sea split, but there was a wind blowing all day today, and it was a very powerful wind, and we don't usually get winds like that around here, so maybe it's just a fluke. Therefore, I'm going to enter into the sea and pursue the Jews. That was what would go through Pharaoh's mind at that point. So there was some room for doubt that maybe this is not God here, and therefore, so anybody in the right mind would have said, I'm not going near them anymore. They would have said that after the second plague, after the first plague. But Pharaoh, as we know, he was stubborn. God hardened his heart, he hardened his own heart. But he had a hard heart, which means he was stubborn, and therefore there was a reason why he would pursue the Jews, because it wasn't 100% clear to him that this was God involved at this point.
In fact, each time he asks Moshe to make the plague go away, he doesn't say to Moshe, ask Hashem to make it. He says, you do
make it. Right, you do it. You're pulling some tricks here. You figure it out. Right, it's a good point. So you might have tremendous miracles, which would amaze all of us, but there's always that some slight room for doubt. Somewhere along the way, someone can say, well, maybe not. And that's because it's up to us, based on our own human minds, to reveal God. And God's never going to just say, hi, here I am. This is me, because that's going to remove free choice from the human being. Yeah?
This is really well thought out. I haven't baked this in my mind for long, so this is not contrary to what you're saying. It's more like in support of what you're saying.
Okay.
But Paro doesn't have your Yiras Hashem, just to begin with. So is it by definition a person who doesn't have your Yiras Hashem always going to just try to, justify it to something other than it being the power of Hashem?
That's for sure true. I mean, somebody who has Yiras Hashem, someone who's a believer, fear of God. So they're going to be looking for God. Therefore, when you see a miracle, you're going to say, wow, that's God right there. Some without it, so they're less likely to take that jump, because if their mind isn't set on the idea there is a God out there who's controlling the world, so then they're going to try to figure out, well, I don't believe in God, so it must be X, Y, or Z that's happening right now. So I think that's 100% true. I mean, you said, yeah.
But on that line, if we see something that we believe is an act of God, are we not supposed to say it's a miracle, just say that was God? Like, should we not credit God as being a miracle, just credit God as being that that is God?
No, we should. We should credit God with a miracle. But it's up to us to credit God. God isn't saying, here's a miracle for you. The human mind is not supposed to figure out it's a miracle.
But are we supposed to see... I'm not saying this well. Are we supposed to just see God as being so powerful to do things, that that is God, that you know, he's both human, and not view it as like, a miracle would be like casting God and like, well, this is God, and this is God on a very good day. So I'm just wondering if maybe we shouldn't see a miracle, just see the acts of God.
I think what you're saying, tell me if I'm wrong, is that the truth is we should view everything as an act of God. Right? Yeah, really, right. Every day, the fact that we're alive, that there's a world, that we breathe, that anything happens, God is there making things run. Nature is just as miraculous as miracles
right,
are.
Right.
So if you point out a miracle, what you're doing in essence is saying, well, really, today God is more involved. Today there's more God here than yesterday. That's kind of what you're saying?
Right, yes.
Yeah.
So there's a book with all kinds of things, like a rainbow.
Right.
It's all different.
To recognize.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So I think you're right, but there's two ways of understanding it. And on the one hand, the highest level of understanding is that there's no difference between nature and miracles. It's all God. The story, the Gemara tells a story, a famous story about the daughter of, I think it was the daughter of Rav Chanina ben Dosa. And one Shabbos, she accidentally put vinegar into the candles instead of oil. So she was a little upset. The candles aren't going to light. It's going to be a problem. I have to go switch it. There's not much time left. So her father tells her father, who was kind of known to be a miracle worker, but her father said, the one who told oil to burn will tell vinegar to burn. Meaning that in his eyes, like, what's the difference? Why does oil burn? Because God says oil should burn. So vinegar will burn today. What's the difference? And why and nature is a miracle too. Nature also, God commands oil to burn, God commands vinegar to burn. So he saw things all on the same plane. There's people out there who are able to see that the fact that gravity is in existence now and will be in 5 minutes is just as miraculous as the splitting of the sea, because it's all God there saying this should happen right now. So that's a very high level. I think on the level of most human beings, their level is that, we view nature as kind of a constant. We don't always perceive God as the constant one commanding nature to occur. And therefore, when a miracle happens, that's something out of the ordinary. You're supposed to point that out and say, God's stepping in right now. But there's definitely different levels. And people on very high levels should be able to see nature as God 100%. The Gemara tells us also, the Gemara says that if you say, we know that on a Yom Tov, we say Hallel. Right, Hallel is what we say on Yom Tov, we say Rosh Chodesh. So Gemara says, if someone who says Hallel daily is considered Mechar Megadif, it's like heresy. It's something which is heretical. So if you say Hallel every single day, you're insulting God. So the commentary is, why is Hallel, I miss Hallel every day, why not? I'm praising God extra today, what's the big deal? The answer is because, the commentaries explain, if you said Hallel daily, at that point you're minimizing the miracles. Because, when God performs a miracle, he's performing a miracle for a reason. The fact that we had an Exodus, or that we had Matan Torah, that God gave us the Torah, the fact that we see miracles in front of us, Hanukkah. So God, in those situations, is showing, there's daily life, and there's times where I just step in, and I do things which are out of the ordinary, to protect you, and to be there for you. If you say Hallel daily, you're minimizing that aspect of the way that God runs the world. Because now you're saying, okay, the miracle of Hanukkah, or the miracle of Exodus, is not so special. But today is the same way. So on one level, we'd say, well, wait a minute. That person's on a very high level because they're recognizing the fact that God is there even today, just as he was when the oil burned on Hanukkah for 8 days. On the other hand, on a normal person's level, we're supposed to see miracles as miracles and nature as nature. And we know that God's the one who set up nature and God runs nature, and the fact that nature works is based on God. But we definitely see miracles as something kind of separate. So the Gemara says, one should not say Hallel daily. You should say Hallel on special occasions, special miracles, and daily we have other things we say. But Hallel is reserved to point out the miracles in life. That's what the Gemara tells us.
Thank you.
Sure.
On the other hand.
Yeah.
In the Shacharit davening, the verses for Shema, Hamakadesh Tugo B'chol Yom Tamim Nitzayim Shri. We mention it every day.
Right. Right. We mentioned that God is the one who renews nature, and that God is the one who is providing that the laws of nature working day in and day out. That we do mention.
I hope this isn't too superfluous, but I remember about 10 years ago when I found out that not every kilo says Anya's Maris on Shabbos, that's more than Minhag.
Yeah.
I don't even know why.
Right.
Maybe it's for a little talking practice, or maybe, but it's, you're not good enough to say that.
Yeah. Right. So that's what's explained by Rabbi Chaim Shulevitz, is that God works in ways which nothing's ever going to be 100% clear, because it's our job as human beings that we're supposed to be using our minds. So even if you see the splitting of the sea, and you say, that's God right there, which is very easy to say when you watch the sea split, but that's your own personal decision, because there is some 0.05% that maybe it wasn't God. So now you've made the decision to find God in that situation. And that's your decision. That is your job as a human being, that you're supposed to always uncover and find God in the world. But never will God just say, hello, here I am. That's, you know, we talk about this world is the world where things are kind of like a facade. You know, things in front of us are not as they seem. When somebody, after 120 years, somebody dies and goes up to the next world, that's where you see everything clearly. That's the old emes is called, the world of truth. And then you see God in front of your eyes. In this world, God's never in front of our eyes. God's always hidden in some way. Even when you see a miracle, that miracle itself is always going to have some slight room for doubt, but there's always room for doubt somewhere along the way. Yeah.
When the third base of Mikdash comes, we're still here when we see Hashem's presence in this world.
It seems so. At that point, there will be another revelation of God. At that point, it does seem to be that we will see God in this world. But that's already considered another period of this world. So at that point, the world will function differently as well. But it does seem at that point there will be a much more obvious understanding of God in the world. So that's all based on the Sefer HaChinuch. Now there is a point by Rav Hirsch, who we often quote in this class. Rav Hirsch points out, when it comes to the mitzvah of lighting the fire on the altar, that the Torah is compared to the fire. It's referred to as Eish Das. The fiery law, the fiery religion. No, Eish Das. We say in Parshas Yosef Racha, Mimino Eish Das Lamo. There was a fiery law given to them from God's right hand. God says, we have a verse that says, Ko Devar, I forgot the actual wording, I didn't write it down, but it's Ko Devarai Keish, something along those lines. All my words are fire. Can't remember the full exact quote, but all my words are fire. I mean, we compare the words of God to fire. So Rav Hirsch writes, the Torah, I'll read you his quote, Torah is like fire, illuminating and warming, refining and reviving, penetrating our whole being. That's what Rav Hirsch writes. He always writes very beautiful poetic terms. So it's illuminating, warming, refining, reviving, and penetrates our whole being. Meaning that Torah is like a fire in the sense, illuminating, you know, it shows us light, teaches us where to go, it enlightens us. It's warming, that it should make us feel a sense of meaning, sense of belonging, sense of the fact that our life is accomplishing, that we're doing something. We should feel warm based on the Torah. It refines us. It helps us become greater people. It revives us. The Torah is something which should give us energy. The fact that we have a lot to accomplish, that we have a lot to live up to, we have a lot that what we do matters to God. It should penetrate our entire life. The fire absorbs all of its path. Fire burns up what's in front of it. So really, the Torah should burn up every part of Jewish life, meaning that the Torah should come and impact everything we do in some way. As Rav Hirsch writes, we fuel the fire of Torah with our actions. The fire of Torah is the godliness which burns in our world. And we bring the new wood to the altar every single day. It keeps this concept fresh and alive. The Torah has to be constantly refueled in a person. Meaning that the Torah, in a certain sense, is the fuel that makes a person move in this world. For a Jew, the Torah should be our fuel. Torah should give us energy. Torah should give us excitement. Torah should give us meaning. Torah should give us warmth, sense of belonging, sense of fulfillment. So when we talk about a constant fire burning, it's a metaphor for the Torah in a person. And that's supposed to be a constant burning in a person, which is supposed to consume all in that person's life. The rabbis tell us that the concept of maintaining a fire was even when they were traveling. In the desert, they had an altar as well, in the Mishkan. And in the desert, it was portable. They took it up and they would travel with it. Even when they were traveling and those sacrifices were being burned, they still had to maintain the fire. And the different commentaries explain the message in that is that Torah should be with us at all times, even when we're traveling. The fire is always burning in a Jew. The Torah is an energy force behind all that we do. It's something which consumes all that we do. Even when you're on the road, even when things are not as stable as usual, the Torah is still there, providing for us, fueling us, keeping us going, giving us our energy. In Hasidic thought, the concept of the fire on the altar represents the person's heart. And the fire on the altar represents the inner burning desire to connect to God. That's what the Hasidic Svarim say. Hasidic thought, men often take things as metaphors for different types of things, so therefore the altar refers to the heart, which others say as well, and fire refers to the inner burning to connect to God. And that inner burning, the inner desire, the inner motivation of Jew to connect to God is a constant burning. The energy is constantly there. And Jews have to keep their service of God fresh and alive at all times. It's interesting, the Hebrew word used for enthusiasm or excitement, we call it hislahavus. Hislahavus, the word lahav is a flame. And hislahavus means that you're a flame. That's the energy, that's the ambition in a person. That's the excitement, the enthusiasm in a person. Because a person that the fire presents that enthusiasm a person has. Every Jew has to be enthusiastic about observing Torah and about serving God. It's not supposed to be a dry, boring ceremony, but we're supposed to feel alive. We're supposed to feel we're on fire. That we're energetic about it. We're excited about it. This burning desire in every Jew to serve God, the Hasidic thought tells us, was placed there by the patriarchs and matriarchs. When Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Sarah, Rachel and Leah, when they did their service of God, they implanted in all of their children, for all generations, this inner desire to serve God. Some refer to it as a pintle yid, this little dot in a person, this in the neshama, which is there to fuel us and to excite us and to give us energy to serve God, which every Jew has, whether they're affiliated or not, whether they're observant or not, that pintle yid, that burning fire to serve God is there. It's actually alluded to. Again, based in Hasidic thought, it's alluded to in the first blessing of Shemoneh Esrei. The first blessing of Shemoneh Esrei, we end, Baruch Ata Hashem, blessed are you God, Magin Abraham, the shield of Abraham. So what does it mean, Magin Abraham, the shield of Abraham? So Hasidic thought would tell you that every Jew within them has a shielded part. Inside of ourselves, there's a shielded part, which is this kernel of spirituality, which was implanted there by Abraham as the first monotheist, the first Jew. And that can't be touched, that can't be broken, that remains through every generation and every single Jew, this shielded, protected kernel of excitement, kernel of fire, kernel of energy to serve God. That's the Magin Abraham, that's the shield of Abraham. When the fire is burning strong in a person, this spiritual fire, this spiritual energy to serve God, so that's going to consume all evil. Because if you're on fire, if you have this idea of Hislavus, this enthusiasm in serving God, so fire burns all in its path. The fire of the Torah, the fire of God, is going to burn away the evil around the person, burn away the Yetzer Hara, the desire to do evil, burn away inappropriate thoughts. We refer to it as Esh Kodesh, the holy fire which is there, which keeps on burning. The person who has this fire, this energy, this enthusiasm in them, so that's going to make everything be consumed, besides the holiness and the purity. We keep the fire fueled. It says in the verse in Proverbs, Ner Mitzvah Torah Or, that a mitzvah is referred to as a candle, and the Torah is the light, or the fire. Because the fuel for a Jew is Torah study. Torah study fuels a Jew. You know, there's Jews out there who might perform certain mitzvahs, but if they don't understand, they don't study Torah, they don't get that same meaning, excitement out of it. Because Torah study is the fuel for a Jew, which makes this excitement, which kind of kindles and fuels this fire, burning fire within to serve God. And that's constantly there. It's the fuel for the soul. The Zohar writes, the Kabbalistic thought, that a mitzvah, if we perform a mitzvah, that could be extinguished by sin. But the Torah can never be extinguished by sin. Which is explained to mean that a mitzvah is an action. The mitzvah can be a very dry action as well. The Torah is something which is that of the mitzvah which impacts you. The understanding, the meaning behind it, the focus, the devotion in the mitzvah. That's referred to as the Torah, because the Torah is the thought that goes into it. So therefore, a person can perform a mitzvah act, which is a dry physical act, and that's a very special thing, and that brings a person a merit in heaven. But sins can actually extinguish that mitzvah, is what the Zohar tells us. But the way the mitzvahs impact the person on a deeper level, the Torah which comes out of that mitzvah, meaning the understanding, the feelings, the emotions, the intellectual understanding of how to do it, those are things which can never be extinguished, because the fire of Torah is never extinguished by anything else. So that's coming with Hasidic and Kabbalistic thought. We look at it on a much more metaphoric level. That fire burning on the altar is the fire burning within every single Jew, and that fire, if it constantly burns, is going to burn away all evil and can never be extinguished. Even by sins, that fire will never be extinguished. And that stems from that initial spark placed within us by Abraham, by our patriarchs and matriarchs, which is shielded off, and that spark always is there. If you have the pilot light going, you can always light more and more. So we have our pilot light as Jews. The pilot light's always within us. Once the pilot light is there, you can always add more fuel, and then it's going to create a great fire. So the mitzvah of adding fire to the altar, again, seemingly a simple mitzvah, carries in it the message of being blessed through the services we do to God. Because it's the message of Sefer Chinuch, which is that God performs miracles in subtle ways, in ways which are hidden, because not everything is going to be presented to us on a silver platter. It also has this concept of the fire burning within every single Jew, in our inner altar, within ourselves. There's a famous song, a famous Jewish song. It's based on a quote. I believe the quote is from what's called the Sefer HaCharedim, Bilvavi Mishkan Evne. It's a beautiful song. You know, in my heart, I will build a sanctuary, Lahadar Kavodo, to beautify his honor. You have a Mishkan. In the inner sanctuary, I'll place an altar. And it says, V'ner Tamid, for the eternal fire, I'll take the flames of the Akedah, of the binding of Isaac. And for a sacrifice, I will offer myself, my soul. So it's this image of a Jew building within themselves a sanctuary, having an altar within themselves, having a fire which is given to us from our patriarchs, from Abraham and from Isaac. And on that, we offer our souls to God, and we offer all of our actions. Let that fire consume everything we do and impact all that we do in life. Any questions? Okay.